Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets where we saw a rotation into non-tech stocks. Ross checks out gold, crude, and the U.S. and Canadian dollars. He also has a special offer for our listeners. The founder of thetrendletter.com, Martin Straith, tells us investors didn't seem overly impressed with NVIDIA's earnings report. He's concerned government job growth is greatly outpacing private sector employment. He also gives us his outlook for uranium, gold, crude, and the U.S. dollar. Market historian Bob Hoy gives us some perspective on what's happening in the markets, especially gold. He believes being the senior currency, the U.S. dollar will weather whatever economic situation comes up. Bob also answers listener questions. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find timely market commentary and insightful technical analysis. You can find him on X at Charts by Ross. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Good to be with you, Jim.
How would you describe what happened on the stock markets this week?
Well, you know, with the exception of the last half hour of trading, it was weak to put you to sleep here. We had the smallest trading range in the S&P that we've had in the better part of, 2 months now. You know, we had huge action in August, early August on the downside, then, you know, record-breaking action on the upside. But we're in that consolidation phase right now for that part of the market. But, you know, we've been seeing this rotation where you had the Magnificent Seven, the NVIDIAs of this world, just leading everything into April through June. The action there has really, really subsided. They're having these broad consolidations, but the unweighted index for the S&P, when you take out the, you know, the big market cap items, we're sitting at all-time highs on that one. And the, you know, other areas like the industrials, the financials, the materials, and you take a look at the ETFs on these, utilities, REITs, healthcare, staples, they are all sitting now at new highs for the year and have got momentum going for them. So, you know, for all that the summer was to be a doldrums, it's ended up with some pretty good winners in it. You know, here we are just finishing off August, which historically is usually a decent month, but we know that September, October can be down, but not so much in election years, so that, you know, we'll look to see what type of a correction comes in at this point. But for now, the trend is there. I mean, here we are. We've got Berkshire Hathaway on, you know, Warren Buffett's birthday. It's got a market cap of over $1 trillion, $1.03 trillion, sitting at all-time highs. And, you know, he's been taking a lot of money off the table in stocks such as Apple, and you know, there's one that had made a good run and is just moving sideways these days. But his action has been pretty good. A little caveat there, though. The indicators that we look at, I've got some overbought readings in Berkshire, the stock. This is, I got 10 out of 13 signals on the weekly charts going back into the 1990s produced good downside corrections. So wouldn't be at all a surprise that even Berkshire, which has had this great run, looks to roll over here in the next week or two and stage a correction in itself.
What's going on with gold?
Gold has found this level just over 2,500, got up here a week and a half ago, and hasn't been able to do much since then. The strength has clearly run out of steam. We got big overbought readings 10 days ago and have just thrashed around on the daily charts. The weeklies, we end up with, on a short-term basis, the weekly charts are overbought, but when we look at it on a medium term, they're high but not at an extreme. So typically what happens from here is that we'll see a correction, usually back to the 50-week moving average, and that's right now around 2250. And as I say, we're sitting just over 2,500, so there could be a bit of a correction from that perspective. That was just based upon price momentum. But if we look at the sequential nines right now are in place on the weekly chart. And on that one, I've got data going back that we go all the way back to 1975, when Americans were once again allowed to own gold, and 80% or 78% of the time that we've been into a position like this, we've seen a correction back to the 50-week moving average. 12% of the time it held at the 20-week moving average. So basically, you know, you've got 90% chance of a decent correction coming in gold. And I would say first week with a lower low would be the catalyst for the correction, at which point we want to be looking to be pretty darn aggressive at picking up some miners on a decent break, maybe in the next 8 to 10 weeks. And at that point, you start to think about the positive seasonal that would take you through Christmas into January.
What's going on with crude?
Crude, there's another one just stuck inside a trading range. We're 73 and change right now. I don't read much into it. If we can get it down under 70, maybe we'll get some signals. But for now, seasonality is heavy, there's nothing fundamentally that's driving it up or down. You got nothing politically that's pushing it either way. So it's, to me, it's a market to just stand aside from.
What's going on with the U.S. and Canadian dollars?
Okay, so the dollar has been one of our really, the one that we've had a really good handle on here. The cyclic work suggested that we, for the last 2-3 years now, we've been bottoming out on the dollar index on average every 58 days, and that low was to have occurred this week. The dollar had been down to par and change, and on the index itself, at which point we got some really good oversold signals. The RSI got down to 27. The various indicators that we look at on sequential, both the sequential 13 and the combo, produce buy signals. One was 3 days before the bottom, and the other was on the bottom day. And now we've seen just a really nice reversal. The dollar index looks as though it'll probably get up around the 102.5 level from par. So this has been a pretty good move. The 20-week or the 20-day moving average should serve as a resistance level. And if we back off from there and then push back up through it, and the moving average starts to turn, that will be a real negative as far as gold is concerned. So, you put the two together, gold is it's ready for a correction. The dollar index has had this good move, and if it starts to gain some steam, that would take the wind out of the gold market. Now, independently, the British pound, the euro, the yen, They all have sell signals right now. It's been an excellent run for those ones on the upside. The Canadian dollar, same type of thing. We're up into the selling mode as far as we're concerned right now on the Canadian. So, you know, this has been a nice run from, what, from 72 to 74 and a quarter. At this point, I think has got downside room.
Ross, do you have a special offer for our listeners?
Yes, the 25% off for new subscribers for an annual subscription, and they can find that on the front page of the website, chartsandmarkets.com. And for people looking for junior golds and the potential names to identify as we go into hopefully a bit of a correction in the precious metals, top right-hand corner of the website, chartsandmarkets.com, there's a spot there where they can click on a link for the junior gold names.
Ross, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Pleasure to be with you, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. You can find him on X at Charts by Ross. Coming up, Martin Strath next on This Week in Money.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Martin Strath, founder of Trend News Online at thetrendletter.com. He's speaking to us from Coquitlam, BC, which is just east of Vancouver. Welcome back to This Week in Money and happy long weekend.
Well, thank you, Jim, and you too.
The big market event this week was NVIDIA's earnings report, which generally was quite positive. When you were last on, you said if earnings were merely decent, it would signal a top. But what's your take now?
Yeah, well, you know, NVIDIA did have a decent earnings report on Wednesday after the close there. You know, it beat expectations, but it didn't blow them out of the water like previous reports. So it was down yesterday on Thursday, which we expected. It's right now it's trading around about 118, so it's about pretty much flat from yesterday. Now, what we're watching for is we want to see if the dip buyers rush in next week, and if we see NVIDIA spike higher, and if it does that spike suck all the air out of the market and leaving the market with no more buyers? That's something that we're really thinking is very likely to happen, so that's what we're watching for. You know, expectations are through the roof with this company. You know, the CEO, Jensen Huang, you know, this guy's become a rock star. We had the, you know, we had the boom signing last month. You know, there were even watch parties on Wednesday night, you know, watch parties for NVIDIA's earnings. So that tells you how hyped up this market's become. So people are selling other tech stocks to get even longer NVIDIA. So at some point, it gets overdone. And we're going to see if, you know, we're at that point now. And we're, you know, typically if we are, then we're probably at a near-term top. So, and listen, you know, NVIDIA is a great company, and we'd be looking to get back into it. But as I say, at some point, the valuations just get so overdone. Investors start taking some profits. That could build momentum to the downside. So, again, we need to keep an eye on NVIDIA. I would not be at all surprised to see it test its key resistance levels and support levels. So, you know, the 50-day moving average was at 120, so it just dropped below that. The 100-day is at 110, and I wouldn't be surprised even if we got all the way down to the 200-day, which is all the way down to $88. So, you know, NVIDIA needs a good cleansing, and I think if we can get that, it would be a good buying opportunity. But as we sit here today, I just think it's way too frothy.
There's been a lot of data in the last 2 weeks, including the Fed saying it's time to cut, and the 818,000 downward revisions to employment data. What's your take on how this data news is affecting the markets?
Yeah, you know, that was the largest downward revision since, back to 2009 in the financial crisis. But here's what we found really the most troubling of those numbers. You know, there was more than 1 million private sector jobs that were lost in that revision, while the government jobs went up 200,000. And we're seeing a similar trend in Canada. You know, the BC Council, what they call BC Council, BC, I guess, they, since 2022, they're saying that public sector grew by 63,600, while the private sector grew by only 5,300. So 10 times higher growth in government jobs over private jobs, and that is not healthy for the economy. So now one of the sectors that is not in those U.S. revisions is the undocumented and or the what they call illegal workers, I guess. And according to the Pew Research, there's about 11 million undocumented people in the U.S., and 6.8 million are employed. Now, I mean, given that, you know, we just saw that 818,000 jobs had revised, so given the how inaccurate the government data is, I'm not sure how this data could be, you know, on undocumented people could be much better. But let's assume it's semi-accurate. Well, that would mean that there's almost 7 million more people working in the U.S. than the U.S. jobs data shows. So that would suggest that the unemployment situation is not as bad as it appears. So what I watch is the initial unemployment claims. And so far, those numbers have not risen very much, at least not so far. So, and today we just saw the U.S. Fed's preferred inflation gauge, so that's core PCE data. So it was up slightly at 2.62. Of the core PCE, it's the services that has been driving inflation for the last few years, and the service component is up 3.72. So, you know, so that's quite a bit higher than the Fed wants. And, you know, so services, just for reference, that's like housing, healthcare, financial services, insurance, transportation, and it also includes food and accommodation. So as for how all this data affects the markets, well, if the employment picture slowly declines, but not dramatic, then the stocks can survive that. If inflation slowly comes down, again, the markets can survive that. But right now, we're seeing stagflation. So that's where the economy is slowing. Inflation remains higher than 2%. And unemployment keeps rising. So if that continues, that would be more challenging for stocks. And then if we were to get a full-blown recession, well, then the stocks are not going to do well for that. So we've seen the yield curve inverted now for over 2 years. And an inverted yield curve has historically been a very accurate forecast of a recession. So again, if we get a recession, then the stocks are not going to do well.
Jerome Powell, the Fed chair, said it's time to cut rates. He didn't say how much they would cut, just that it was time. What's your take?
Yeah, well, you know, the U.S. Fed, they've got 400 economists with PhDs, and they got a budget of $7.3 billion. So at the end of December, the market, not the Fed, but the market was expecting 6 or 7 rate hikes or cuts. But the Fed, with its 400 PhDs, they kept holding off, you know, with that higher for longer mantra. And then, as you say, at Jackson Hole, Powell comes out and says it's time to cut. Now, the market has been waiting for that announcement for over a year. So the question to me is this one of those buy the rumor, sell the news events? Because as you say, Powell said they're going to cut, but he didn't say by how much. And if we go by today, the market has priced in 8.5 rate cuts in the next year. I mean, that's a lot of cuts. So if the Fed does cut that much, you know, you have to ask, well, why would they cut that much? Well, it would be because they think the economy's in serious trouble. So the big question then is, how worried is the Fed about the U.S. economy? Because if it truly expects just a soft landing and does not plan to cut aggressively, then to me, the stock market can absorb that. But if the Fed is really worried about a full-blown recession and does plan to cut aggressively, that changes everything. So like we just discussed, if the Fed seriously is worried about a recession and cuts aggressively, that's not good for stocks. I think we talked last month or a couple months ago, like we did a video, a very short video back in December. And in the video, it showed what happened with the stock market the last 4 times the Fed aggressively cut rates. And as the video showed, in each of those four times the Fed aggressively cut, we saw the stock market sell off. And, you know, again, that makes sense. You know, if the economy's in trouble, especially if it's headed for a recession, then that's going to hurt a company's revenues. That would drive down share prices. So that would not be good for the general stock market. So with the charts in the video, they showed really clearly that the best time to buy stocks in a Fed rate cut cycle is when the Fed stops cutting rates. And again, that makes sense too, because the reason the Fed would quit cutting rates in each of those examples was because the economy was starting to recover. So that's when you'd want to load up in stock when in an aggressive rate cut cycle, not when they start cutting aggressively.
Where can our listeners access the video where you talk about the rate cuts?
Oh, yeah, they can go to our website, so thetrendletter.com. So that's just one word, all one word, thetrendletter.com. On the homepage, there's a link there, video button. So you just click that and you'll see all the videos we've done. And that one's just basically, I think it's called Fed Rate Cut or something like that.
Last month, you said you expected the Bank of Canada to be much more aggressive in cutting rates than the U.S. Do you still believe that?
I do. You know, the Canadian economy is much weaker than the U.S. You know, our GDP is lower. Productivity is much lower. Unemployment's higher. You know, pretty much every measure of the economy, the U.S. is much stronger. You know, in 2015, you know, coincidentally, when Trudeau came into power, capital investment in Canada has fallen over 14%. Now, according to the Bank of Canada's own projections, the Canadian economy is expected to perform less than half that of the U.S. in the next year, at least. So another key factor is, you know, the difference in mortgage terms. You know, the U.S., the average mortgage term is 30 years. Canada, the average is, 3 to 5 years. So for the average American who owns a home and has a mortgage, if that mortgage doesn't come due for renewal for like 15, 20, 25 years, they have not been affected by the dramatic increase in mortgage rates. But in Canada, you know, RBC says 60% of all Canadian mortgages will need to be renewed between 24 and 2026. Well, we're already halfway through 2024, so many homeowners are already feeling the hit. You know, at the current, you know, mortgage rates, you know, those needing to renew, they're going to face increased mortgage payments of 30 to 35%, according to RBC. So think about that. I mean, a 30, 35% increase in your mortgage payment, you know, especially if you live in, you know, areas like Vancouver, Toronto, other, you know, expensive areas, that's going to take a big chunk of people's monthly income just to pay that mortgage payment. So that puts a lot of pressure on the Bank of Canada to try and, you know, give some relief to those homeowners who are becoming up for renewal. So that's, you know, that's really why the Bank of Canada has to be much more aggressive on these rate cuts.
Stats Canada reports Canada's GDP grew 2.1% in the second quarter. Does that mean we shouldn't fear recession is around the corner?
Well, you know, every month we get these stats, right? And then the next month, the stat just reverses, or they make a revision to it. I don't know. Do you? I mean, if you just look around, you know, what you see. Do you see the economy booming? Do you see it growing? Do you see new investment coming into Canada? Like, you know, companies are leaving the country. They're taking the jobs with them. I just find that you know, if GDP grew by 2.6%, you know, what about productivity by, you know, per individual? How is that coming in? Those are the numbers to me that really count.
You've been a big bull on uranium. What's your take on that now?
Well, yeah, long term, I'm very bullish for all kinds of reasons. But, you know, we will continue to see these, you know, buy the rumor, sell the news kind of scenarios. You know, you can remember back in, November, I think, the COP28 gathering, you know, they had that declaration to triple nuclear energy. And then that gave uranium a nice pop at that point. And then it peaked, it had a high in January, then it sold off, rallied again in May, and it sold off ever since then. Now, next week, there's the World Nuclear Symposium. You know, so that's the main nuclear conference each year. And at that conference, it tends to spur a ton of deals. So I suspect that will happen again this year. like the business case for uranium is still very solid long term. You know, there's about 440 nuclear plants globally in operation in 32 different countries. Primarily, you've got the U.S., France, China, Russia, and Japan, I think, are the main players. There's currently about 59 or 60 plants under construction. There's another 100 or so planned. So, you know, if you take that, you know, COP28, where, the, you know, those 20 countries, including Canada, U.S., France, and the U.K., that they committed to that declaration to triple nuclear energy. So, you know, if they come even close to doing that, well, you've got 440 plants today. To triple that, that would be 1,320 plants. So, you know, you take off the 59 under construction and 100 that are planned, to meet that, you would need to increase over 700 more nuclear plants to get anywhere close to that declaration. So that's a lot of nuclear power. And until fusion energy becomes viable, there's going to need to be a lot of uranium to fuel those plants. And the big key is for nuclear plants, you know, they're very expensive to build. They take a long time to build. But the uranium fuel is a very small percentage of the total operating cost of those plants. So long term, I'm very bullish. Again, recently we've seen the price drop down. It's kind of hanging around the $80 level. So it's been pretty flat for a while. And that's just part of that supply-demand price cycle. So for your listeners, you know, if they don't have any uranium positions right now, I would look to use these kind of dips as opportunities to enter that sector.
Gold continues to hit new highs. Are you sticking to your projection that gold could surpass $3,000 U.S. in the next year?
Yeah, gold's had a great run this year. You know, it's up just under 25% for the year. Down today, it's looking like it's about 25 down about 25 bucks so far. There's several good reasons for gold's ascent here. You know, obviously there's the geopolitical concerns, you know, Russia, Ukraine, Middle East, the China-South Sea conflicts. You know, you've got those BRIC nations looking to create a gold-backed currency, you know, they want to reduce the reliance on the U.S. dollar. And then globally, you know, we've got governments who have some serious fiscal problems. You know, we've got high debt problems in Canada, you know, U.S., and most of the developed countries. I mean, you look at the U.S., you know, their debt is over $35 trillion. Their interest payments, just to pay the interest on their debt now, is over $1 trillion every year. You know, the ratio of the U.S. interest payments as a percentage of their tax receipts in the last quarter rose to 36%. I mean, think about that. 30%, 36% of all tax revenues in the U.S. goes to pay the interest on their debt. So these debts are inflationary. They reduce the purchasing power of the currency. And that's the real key. You know, when Russia invaded Ukraine, you know, the West blocked Russia from using the SWIFT transfer system, and they confiscated Russian assets. Well, I mean, that sent a very clear message to countries that are not good friends of the West. So we're talking, you know, China, Russia, Iran, et cetera. And what did they do? They started loading up on gold. So China was, or still is now, but it's, you know, it's been the second largest holder, foreign holder of U.S. debt behind Japan. So again, so the second largest holder of U.S. bonds. But what have they been doing? They've been selling off bonds. Last 3 years, China has sold over $350 billion worth of bonds. And what are they doing? They're buying gold. So we have investors. They've now realized the purchasing power of all of these paper currencies is declining. So it's not just the U.S. dollar, the Canadian dollar, the euro, the yen. They're all declining. So if you want to protect your purchasing power, investors are now looking at hard assets. And if you want to protect your purchasing power, you need to own gold, Bitcoin, and ultimately you're going to want to own a lot of commodities as well. Now, if we look at seasonality for gold, you know, July and August are typically really strong months, which that certainly played out this year. But September is generally weaker. So, you know, as that thing lines up, you know, we've got the U.S. dollar, which has been really weak. It's been selling off recently with all the Fed cut expectations. But should we get a rally in the U.S. dollar in September, which I think we will, you know, you would then expect gold will pull back. So we're looking for a pullback in gold in September. But that pullback would be another opportunity for people to, you know, add to your position. And so, sorry, to answer your question, yes, in the bigger picture, I do see gold over 3,000 in the next year or so.
What do you see ahead for crude?
Well, there's, you know, kind of conflicting scenarios here. You got, you know, crude right now is trading about 73.60 here on Friday. So it's down about 230 for the day. So if we look at the bullish side, so for higher prices, you know, you've got continued tensions in the Middle East. You've got the Ukraine-Russia scenario. You know, although the war premium has been reduced with some hope of ceasefire talks in the Middle East, at least temporarily, much of Libya's oil production has been shut down due to political protests. Ukraine has been attacking Russian refineries, so that's been limiting some of Russia's production a bit. You've got the hurricane season started, so that's likely going to shut down, you know, 15, maybe 20% of the offshore drilling. But then if you look at the short-term bearish side, so looking at for lower prices, you know, we've got weakening economies in most of the developed countries, including Canada, U.S. and Japan, most of the European countries. You've got China still struggling. You know, we're seeing Russia trying to increase their production because they got to fund their war with Ukraine. Now, just the other day, we see that the OPEC Plus, they're scheduled to start unwinding their 2.2 million barrels per day production cuts. So that's supposed to, you know, start unwinding in October. So that would add to the supply. So short term, we do expect prices to continue to struggle if we do not see an escalation of, you know, Middle East war, and especially if we do not see NATO enter the Russia-Ukraine war, which for whatever reason seems to be more and more likely. Because, I mean, if that happens, we're talking World War III here. So the other big key short term is the recession fears globally. That would put pressure on demand for oil. And also based on seasonality, we are in a weak period for oil, although September, October tends to be a bit better. So I think we're going to continue to test the low 70s, which we're at now. There's very strong support around the $67 level, which has been really strong for the last year or so. So now, if we look at the longer term, you know, you got demand, growing demand, especially in the emerging countries. You know, again, I think I've mentioned this a few times in your show. You know, there's over a billion people in the world without electricity. You know, a lot of people forget, you know, oil is a huge component of so many things that we use every day. You know, your clothing, smartphones, your computers, medical supplies, tires for cars, asphalt for roads. You know, whether you're driving an EV or not, you still need tires, you still need roads. So those are things that we will continue to need. And those are things that people in the emerging countries they need and they want. So demand for oil is not going away. And if we look at supply, you know, you've got the lack of investment, you know, capital expenditures continue to be low, like 30, 40 year lows. You know, rig counts, we publish those, you know, every couple of weeks. You know, they continue to decline. And the reason for that is, you know, you've got governments telling us that they don't want fossil fuels. You know, they seem to forget that their cell phone, their computers, their cars and tires and the asphalt roads they drive on all need oil. So we've got these. So what they've done, they've increased taxes, they've increased regulations, and they didn't, you know, they're not allowing any new permitting. So it's a very simple case of supply and demand. You've got increase in demand, especially in those emerging countries. And then you've got that global concerted effort to squeeze supply. And it's going to result in a big supply problem over the next few years. So that's, you know, our take on oil. We're going to see $100 oil for sure. Very likely 150, probably even higher over the next few years.
What's your take on Bitcoin?
Well, it continues to be volatile, that's for sure. You know, it typically, you know, moves similar to gold, you know, affected by interest rates and inflation. But Bitcoin and the other cryptos are so incredibly volatile. You know, Bitcoin was today, it was down over $1,000 at one point. I think it's down about 600 right now. You know, trading around 58,000. Well, it traded up to 72. It was trading between 62 and 72 for a while. But yeah, it fluctuates. But, you know, it can be a safe haven trade, you know, for geopolitical concerns. But, you know, recently gold certainly outperformed Bitcoin and the NASDAQ for that matter. But I expect Bitcoin will continue to be volatile, but ultimately it's going to do well for people that get in after those big dips. So like gold, with paper currencies losing purchasing power, Bitcoin should do well. Longer term, I really think, you know, buying the dips in Bitcoin and Ethereum makes a lot of sense. You know, it's nice and volatile. When you see one of those big swings down, that would be a time to take a look at adding to it.
What's your take on the U.S. and Canadian dollars?
Well, I'm sure I say this all the time on your show. You know, the big thing with currencies is they're all connected. And it's really always driven by the U.S. dollar. So if the U.S. dollar is strong, then that's negatively going to affect most other currencies, plus the commodities, plus the equities, plus precious metals. And when it's weak, well, then all those other items, you know, they'll rise. So with the expectation and now the confirmation that the Fed is going to start cutting rates, we've seen the U.S. dollar trending down sharply since, I guess all the way back to July. But it's all relative, because if the Bank of Canada, the Bank of England, and the ECB, if they all cut more than the Fed does, well, then the U.S. dollar is likely to remain stronger. You know, there's certainly going to be some downside risk of the U.S. dollar potentially in the election here. I mean, Trump has made it very clear he wants lower rates and a much lower U.S. dollar. So that could push the U.S. dollar lower if it looks like Trump's going to win the election. But longer term, we expect the U.S. economy is going to continue to be stronger than most others, certainly stronger than Canada, certainly stronger than Europe. And that will mean that the U.S. dollar is going to continue to attract investment capital. You know, we don't like any of these paper currencies, but it's really just a case, again, of the U.S. dollar being that least ugly house on the block. It's so important for investors to understand how all of these things are connected. So near-term resistance for the dollar, U.S. dollar would be 103. Today it's about 101.40. Near-term support is 101.20. Now, for the Canadian, you know, at the beginning of August, the Canadian dollar was close to a two-year low, but since then, it's rallied like over 3% now, and today it's trading about 74.20. Now, the last time I was on, we talked about how there was this massive short position against the loonie. And what happens is, as the loonie started to rally with the U.S. dollar declining, well, those people, that massive short positions, well, they had to start covering their shorts, meaning they had to buy the loonie. Well, that just added to the fuel of the rally. So as we just talked here, you know, the Bank of Canada has been much more aggressive in reducing interest rates than the Fed. So that means that U.S. bonds are going to be paying higher yields than the Canadian bonds. So today, the U.S. 10 years trades about, it's giving about, what, 3.9%? Well, the Canadian's giving about 3.15. Well, that's 0.75 percentage point lower than the U.S. So investors can get, you know, 0.75 point higher by buying a U.S. bond over a Canadian bond. Also, you know, I see any rally in the Canadian dollar being temporary. You know, I suspect that we're going to see the Canadian dollar hit 70 or even lower in the next year or so. But as investors, if we look at things like the resource sector, I think Canadian producers are going to do very well here, because their costs are in Canadian dollars, so their labor costs and, you know, equipment, et cetera, while their revenues are in U.S. dollars. So we're talking about things like oil, natural gas, uranium, copper, gold, and silver even, all priced in U.S. dollars. Yeah, and, you know, with oil, you know, we've got the new pipeline now. It's been expanded. So that's going to reduce the discount Canadian producers are receiving. So that's going to be more money for their bottom line. And, you know, like I say, I think oil is going to go to $100 or higher, very likely. And I think the Canadian dollar is going to head to 70 or lower, very likely. Well, that's going to be very positive for Canadian producers. So I think Canadian producers are going to make a killing here. Now, obviously, consumers, it's a whole different story. You know, a weak Canadian dollar is not good news, as that means the cost of imports is going to rise. So essentials, certainly like food, I'm sure every one of your listeners knows that food prices are not, you know, they're not inflated by 2 or 3%. Those prices are much, much higher, and that's going to continue. So that's, you know, that's the negative side. But if you're an investor, investing in Canadian producers, I think it's going to do very well.
Martin, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
My pleasure, Jim. And again, have a great weekend.
My guest has been Martin Straith, founder of Trend News Online at thetrendletter.com. Coming up, Bob Hoy, next on This Week in Money.
Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is market historian Bob Hoy. He's the chief investment strategist for chartsandmarkets.com. He's speaking to us from Vancouver. Welcome back to This Week in Money, Bob.
Yeah, Jim, it's good to be with you and with our listeners out there in, what are we going to call it, audience land, I guess.
Cyberland.
I like that. AI, too. And also, it's a beautiful day in the village next to the rainforest.
Yes. It's a very pleasant long weekend here. Mm-hmm. Bob, you have a special offer at Charts and Markets. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, we are got a list of small cap, or as we call them, junior gold stocks. I think there's about 11 in there, maybe 10, because one might have got taken over. But we put together the list in December when the sector was very depressed. We used the TSE Venture Index as a proxy, and in December this was about as beat up as you can get. And there's been some recovery since, but the reason for looking at the juniors is that when you come out of a bad market for gold stocks, typically the big caps will move first, then the middle and size one, and then finally the small caps. And over the play, sometimes the small caps can outperform the big ones. So it's a good way of going about it with a suite of 10 or 11 small cap gold stocks. Yeah.
There's a massive division in the U.S. caused by propaganda from mass media. Has this happened before in history, and what was the outcome?
Yeah, I've called them tyrannical centuries, where authoritarian government goes berserk, declares war on neighbors, declares war on its own citizens, funds it all with massive inflation. And the first one was the 3rd century in Rome. And it ran for about 100 years. It's hard to pinpoint it. You haven't got a price index back then, but there is a history of the coinage depreciation that was going on, and it was horrendous. And then with the prices soaring, Diocletian came in with price and wage controls, mm-hmm. Emperor Diocletian. So. And then the whole economy kind of collapsed, and nobody could afford big government, and people went back to minding their own business. Now, then the next one brewed up beginning in about 1500, and that was another tyrannical centuries with endless wars, endless inflation, endless intrusion, and even on that one, the movement turned the church leaders into vicious murderers, you know, on behalf of the system. And then in the reform is best followed in England in the early 1600s. And then they had their glorious revolution in 1688, where a peaceful revolution swept the country. King James saw the tide turning against him. He talked about bringing over French troops to quell the uprising, and that was a no-no. So then he saw the inevitability of it all, and he abdicated and moved to France and sought solace in authoritarian France. And then we went into they call it the Protestant reform, and too much time has been spent on the religion side, and it was a great reform. And then now our dreadful experiment began in the early 1900s, and it's the same thing. We've now run for about 120 years, and it is in-your-face and in-your-wallet government. Let's have a war. Let's declare war on our citizens. Let's inflate like mad. And it's the same thing. But we're also, what's exciting now is to watch the tide of ordinary public opinion turn against the perpetrators of all this evil. And it is happening. There could be a refreshing election in the states in November. And then if we can get a certain government to fail in Canada, we could have election. Otherwise, you got to wait till 2025. But change is underway, and it's driven by ordinary people.
Stock markets keep hitting new highs following a crash in early 2020. Do you think the stock bull market can continue with normal corrections along the way?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's up in a way, but what you have here is that we were looking for good stuff through to mid-year, but what came in July and it ran into August was very speculative moves. There were the Magnificent Seven. There were briefly seen small individual stocks suddenly go straight up. So it became extremely overbought, had a quick correction, and then has been recovering of late. And we kind of like to remind people of what happened in September 1929. The market rose into early September 1929. And then also in the 1873 bubble, again in New York, the stock market rose right into September, and then they faded. Now, one of the things with a great financial bubble, Jim, is that when the stock market fails, the economy fails almost at the same time, whereas typically the stock market leads the economy at peaks by about 7 months. As indeed, the authorities use the S&P 500 in their leading indicators, but not at bubble ends, when both the economy and the stock market head south. Yeah.
Gold continues hitting new highs. What do you see ahead for gold, short, medium, and long term?
Yeah, near term, Jim, gold is very overbought. Gold stocks became very overbought. Then technically, excesses have reached from which you would expect an intermediate correction. And then also, we're at the time of year, if things are going to go wrong, they're going to go wrong in the fall. So, you know, we'd be taking some money off the table, even in gold stocks. And there would be time to re-enter at a better price. Now, in the longer term, this would be a correction in a multi-year bull market, where the real price goes up, it outperforms the cost of mining gold, and the gold miners make money like in the 1930s when the rest of commerce and industry is not doing so good. So gold sector can become a much admired sector.
What's the difference between the real price of gold and the nominal price of gold?
Yeah, nominal price of gold is what you see every day, like 3,000 or 2,000 or whatever it is in U.S. dollars or in your own local currency. The real price, as most do, is deflated by the rate of inflation as determined by the Consumer Price Index. But, hey, that CPI only comes out once a month, and that's not very good. So what we do is deflate it by the CRB Commodity Index. You can do it every day. And for the last 7 months or so, gold has been outperforming commodities, which means that bullion price has been outperforming the costs of mining. So it's very happy for the miners. And this can go on for a long time.
It looks like the Fed's going to drop its central rate in September. Do interest rate bull markets tend to move higher in waves?
No. There's an old rule, and as far as back in history as you're going to go, centuries, short-term interest rates such as treasury bills go up in the boom and down in the bust. And we're seeing lately, I'm gathering headlines on this one because people are saying, oh, rates are about to go down and that's good. And then I've got a wonderful one from September 2007 by the head spokesman for Harris Trust. And he said that the falling rates would certainly help the market. Well, this is just straight intuition. Not only does the stock, the S&P, go down as the rates of interest go down, but there are times when both plunge together. A wonderful chart on that we did, and it shows the S&P hitting a vacuum and heading down as the T-bill rate is going down. So this is one of the intuitive things that is just plain wrong. Falling rates are very bad for economies and stocks and that sort of stuff.
What's the bond market doing?
Yeah, we've had... There's a complete absence of risk out there. So lower grade stuff like junk and high yield HYGJNK have been bid up to new highs. As a matter of fact, junk itself is now about as overbought as it gets on the weekly RSI. And I think the best for junk is being put in as we speak. Treasury, long-dated treasuries have been rallying somewhat because the inflation isn't turning out as much as people thought. And so you've had the less inflation story has bid up long treasuries somewhat. But we're going into such a liquidity crisis that junk can get crashed. Many junk bond issues can fail, like no bid, gone, bye-bye, into the trash can. And the liquidity crisis can be severe enough that even long bond prices would go down. So people can also inquire as to what the ideal investment in any kind of a storm, and we'll be glad to respond to that one.
What do you think the real rate of inflation is?
If it's the measure by the CPI, that's what it is. And you can also measure it by the CRB, a commodity index. So, yeah.
Our friend Hilliard Macbeth, when I asked him, what do you think the real rate of inflation is? He says, it all depends on what you spend your money on.
I like that one.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it reached a few months ago, the highest in 40 years. And you had various things to contend with. You had the huge self-enforced vacuum with the COVID lockdown, and that slammed everything down, and then everything came back, and people just trying to get normal, bid things up. So, I'll tell you one thing: the big concern next year likely will be weak pricing power.
Does inflation cause the price of stocks and commodities to rise?
No. No, inflation as calculated by the CPI is bind events. If you want to know what prices are doing, look at the CRB commodity index or maybe even the producer price index. But with the calculation of inflation, it's just done once a month. So anyways, it's best just to watch the commodities, and they are off of their high. I think the high was in May. They've declined but haven't crashed. And the price of crude, of course, is down hugely from its last high. So the consumer price inflation story is going away.
The new and used vehicle markets are slowing. Is this an indicator of tough economic times ahead?
Yeah. Also, with the new ones, it's also a revulsion for electric cars. They're saying these things are ridiculous. So the major car manufacturers have lost huge in a futile effort to make a ridiculous car.
Well, right now, Bob, every car has got so much computerized equipment. How come, they could make a much more affordable vehicle if they just made something that got you from point A to B and wasn't loaded with more computers than NASA?
Oh, yeah, I imagine they could.
I would love a car like that.
I think I'm looking around. Maybe I might want to buy a 1970s Morris Minor convertible.
Oh, that would be nice.
Very simple.
Yeah. You can fix it with a pair of pliers and a wrench.
Yeah.
And a screwdriver.
Yeah.
What's the difference between a recession and a depression, and could we be heading for one?
Okay, recession is sort of in the nature of the business cycle, where you can have a few years of a business recovery. It ends with a boom, and then you have a recession. And then a depression is what follows a great financial bubble. The great financial bubbles have been ended in 1929, followed by a Great Depression, also 1873 bubble. And in 1880, economists in London started calling it the Great Depression. So calling the post-bubble contraction the Great Depression has been on for quite a while. And then there was one following the 1825 bubble, and all the way back to 1720 with the first great financial bubble. So, they are followed by recessions, and four out of five post-bubble periods were followed by great depressions. So we'll see what happens with this one.
Well, a recession is what, two consecutive quarters of negative growth?
Oh, yeah, that's
technically
one.
Yes, well, stats...
No, recession is when your neighbor is out of work, and the depression is when you're out of work.
Stats Canada says Canada's GDP went up 2.1% last quarter.
Yeah.
Are those numbers believable?
I don't know. I don't look at those numbers too closely.
Is the U.S. dollar still the go-to currency in these turbulent times?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the senior currency becomes chronically firm in a post-bubble contraction. And I think that this is one of the mechanisms behind it, is that during the debt bubble, a huge amount of debt is issued, and a lot of it is due and payable in U.S. dollars into New York. So the debt bubble out there is, in a manner of speaking, a short position of dollars that eventually be covered. And if you go back to the 1550s, when Thomas Gresham was England's financial agent in the money market in Antwerp, and he writes back saying describing the problem of servicing debt from a weak local currency into a firm senior currency. So, the U.S. dollar can become so firm, there'll be great despair at many levels.
How's the Canadian dollar looking?
Weak, extremely poor government in Ottawa, federally, anti-business, anti-people, pro-carbon tax. They're going to sacrifice Canada's economy to save the world's climate. And that's what they're working on. Absolutely insane government. So, and the problem is they don't have to call an election until 2025. So Trudeau can stay there and do his worst for as long as he's feeling evil. And it is not going to help the Canadian dollar.
Bitcoin, do you care?
No.
The BRICS are working on a currency they call the unit. It's digital and would be 40% gold back. What kind of an impact is that going to have on world
trade? Oh, that's very interesting. I haven't seen that one, Jim. Now, Bitcoin, without the stock market, I wonder if it would exist. You know, it's become an important counter to play in the biggest bubble in history.
Is there anything that could stop the debt bubble from just continuing to grow and grow?
No, you've got the excesses reached in junk and in commodities and everything. So the upside, when you take a look at all the hot games, has been extraordinary. and the downside is often discovered late in September.
Agriculture is being destroyed around the world by governments. Are the agriculture markets a good indicator of what could lie ahead?
Yeah, well, in Holland and the Greens, they're control freaks, got all upset about farmers putting nitrogen in the soil. And all they're doing is replacing the nitrogen that is taken out by growing things. And then also, it must have been a 1,000 years ago when farmers discovered that crop rotation was good. And if you put peas or lentils in, it was good. They didn't know why, but it was fixing nitrogen in the soil. But even Trudeau in Ottawa last year and came out and said that he was attacking the farmers for using nitrogen, and the nitrogen has to be replaced. So you've got people with a lot of authority and very little understanding in too many governments.
Real estate sales and prices are slowing in Canada. Could we be in for a real estate bust?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember 1980 in Vancouver here, a very hot real estate market, and extremely bid up in British properties, which was sort of executive land, everybody living expense account, and price of crude oil up to huge high prices, 147. That was 2008. But anyways, very high crude oil prices, and then it all came down. And the British properties sector of Vancouver, home prices fell to one-third of the high. That's not off by a third, but to one-third of the high. And then in more normal Vancouver, Kerrisdale, they fell in half. And then also in Toronto, there was some grand house seized by the trust company because the promoter failed on something. The Financial Post was writing it up every once in a while. The house fell, and it finally cleared the books at one-third of the high price. So it wasn't just Vancouver. So house prices can drop quite a bit and stay down for quite a while.
Of course, Vancouver faces the pressure of about 50,000 people a year moving into the lower mainland. Does that counter this drop in real estate prices?
That growth input of people can slow down. A post-bubble contraction changes the world, so to speak.
Throughout history, when governments turn authoritarian, do the people wake up and rise up?
Oh, yeah. Like revolution, the French Revolution, public was dissatisfied and neurotic intellectuals got control of the movement, and it turned it into a bloody reign of terror revolution. And then the better one is, let's call it the reform, and the best example was the glorious revolution of 1688. One can look it up. The Wikipedia is not all that long, and it describes the Glorious Revolution quite well. So let's call it, what we're looking for now is a glorious reformation, and I believe it has already started.
Do you think when we have billionaires like Musk and Jeff Bezos worth hundreds of billions, do you think the average person's going to say that's too much for one person to own? I want some of that.
I expect there's envious people out there, yeah.
Crisis equals opportunity. Do you see opportunities on the horizon?
Yeah, in gold's real price from time to time. Most everything else is going to be facing weak prices.
Where can people find out more about the chart and market's special offer?
Yeah, well, we've got two things on that we're doing. One is the list of juniors, and the other is that 20% off of a new subscription with a new subscriber, good for the next 3 weeks. How about that for goodies?
And Bob, before we wrap up our section on This Week in Money, on our weekly show, we always like to get to listener questions. So we do have a bunch of questions from Michael. He starts off with a disturbing headline from Market Watch: Dollar General crashes on most record after management warns a financially constrained core customer. The General, with over 20,000 super discount stores, is just too expensive. Walmart is now finding that its customer base is now the affluent. And that was in quotation marks, like, what's affluent nowadays? Bob, since jobs are being replaced by AI, unemployment rising and wages stagnant, is severe deflation eventually the only solution to putting things right again?
I wouldn't say that it's a solution, and it's definitely not going to be a policy, but we're going to run into a post-bubble contraction. And part of it will be prices, not the CPI inflation calculator going down to about zero and staying there.
Next question from Michael. Has the U.S. dollar bottomed, and will it rise to new highs in the fall, assuming a market sell-off?
You're right on that one. You got a good eye. Yeah, we mentioned the dollar and being the senior currency, and typically it becomes chronically firm in a post-bubble mess.
How much can gold potentially pull back when the overall market sells off?
Or we've just called it an intermediate pullback on gold price in U.S. dollars, maybe for a couple of months correction.
And also from Michael, will interest rate cutting cycle eventually cause inflation to return?
No. We've mentioned that falling interest rates after a bubble is a disaster, and the Fed, T-bill rate will go down, and the Fed will follow, and everything else will go down as well. So it's a disaster.
Bob, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Jim, we put it together, and thank you kindly, and we'll look forward to next week.
And if you have any questions for Bob, you can send them to info@howstreet.com, and we'll ask that question for you. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Martin Straith, and Bob Hoy, the Chief Investment Strategist for chartsandmarkets.com. If you have any questions for the show or for our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.